three rows in front of me, a guy's backpack just started smoking and then burst into orange and blue flame.
A fire scare on an Alaska Airlines flight. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 31st of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Fairbanks is mourning the death of Sergeant Alan Brandt.
This man was so selfless. He actually said other cops have done more than he has done.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future. From military might to counterculture cool to camo chic, camouflage in plain sight exposes the ancient yet modern art of concealment. See camouflage at the Anchorage Museum through February the 5th. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum.
Passengers on an Alaska Airlines flight from Seattle to Anchorage on Sunday were delayed more than 5 hours after a passenger's backpack started burning. Batteries for an e-cigarette are the likely culprit. KCAW's Robert Woolsey has the story.
Flight 67 had just made a scheduled stop in Ketchikan at 3:30 Sunday afternoon, and about half the passengers had deplaned when the incident occurred. Andrew Hames was seated just a few rows behind the passenger.
And I heard a whooshing sound, like a quick hiss of air, and I looked up, and about three rows in front of me, a guy's backpack just started smoking and then burst into orange and blue flame, and he quickly got it off and hit it to the ground, and some other passengers jumped up and started stomping on it.
Hames says the man thought the source of the fire might have been an e-cigarette, but that wasn't the complete answer. After all passengers had stepped off into the Ketchikan airport, Hames spoke briefly with the man as he emptied out his pack.
And he said it was this device, and he held up the charger itself. And it looked like, and he said there were some coins in the bottom, and I think somehow it made contact with that. And so he also had several charred quarters sitting there on the table as well.
Hames also says the man appeared quite chagrined and cooperated fully with authorities in the airport. In a prepared statement, Alaska Airlines confirms that freshly charged batteries were to blame. Spokesperson Ann Zaninovich also doesn't call this event a fire.
Technical experts believe that when the battery came in contact with some metal keys and coins, it caused a spark. There was visible smoke, and a set of keys and candy fell to the ground through a burnt hole in the backpack. While there was not fire, there was sparking, which prompted the flight attendants to take swift action and use the fire extinguisher.
Zaninovich says that out of an abundance of caution, the aircraft's first officer put a device in a fire containment bag, which is carried on all of the airline's planes. She offered no comment on whether the incident would affect rules regarding the transport of e-cigarettes or battery chargers on aircraft. Andrew Hames, however, considers the event an eye-opener.
Underneath the airplane, maybe in the luggage compartment, and somehow that same event had happened. It absolutely could have been a much more exciting than it already was.
Another aircraft was sent to take passengers on to Juneau and to Anchorage. Hames and his family arrived in Sitka about 5 hours behind schedule. The original aircraft used for Flight 67 was put back into service about 6 hours later. A 12-inch square of burnt carpet had been replaced. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
In another sign that this is a strange election year, the U.S. Senate campaign of Libertarian Joe Miller is mailing leftover flyers the Alaska Republican Party printed in 2010 but didn't send. The flyers are critical of the incumbent, Senator Lisa Murkowski. In 2010, she was the candidate the party was trying to defeat in the general election. Now, though, Murkowski is the Republican nominee, so the Republicans are crying foul. The GOP has filed a report with the Anchorage Police Department, and party chairman Tuckerman Babcock says the Postal Service informed him it is also looking into it.
I don't know whether they were printed up recently and not reported, or whether someone hoarded them in their garage for 6 years, hoping that there would be another contest as Miller and Murkowski. I don't know, but it's a pretty bizarre situation.
Joe Miller said last week someone dropped off boxes of the leftover 2010 GOP flyers at his campaign.
Many boxes were brought. I wasn't here when they were brought.
Miller treated it as a contribution from the party to his campaign worth $4,500 and reported that on his campaign finance report. A Miller spokesman says the campaign paid a printer to black out the original bulk mail permit and added paid for by Citizens for Joe Miller. They affixed first-class stamps and mailed an undisclosed number of them. Babcock says the mailer would confuse voters because it has the original disclosure saying it's paid for by the Alaska Republican Party and another saying the Miller campaign paid for it. Fairbanks is mourning the loss of a police officer. 34-year-old Sergeant Alan Brandt, who was shot earlier this month, died Friday of complications following surgery to remove shrapnel from one of his eyes. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the Fairbanks community gathered for a candlelight vigil Friday night to honor and remember the 11-year FPD veteran.
Hundreds of people held candles in the parking lot of the Fairbanks Police Department Friday night as Acting Police Chief Brad Johnson, visibly shaken by the unexpected death of Sergeant Brandt, addressed the gathering.
I want you to know that all of us here feel your love. We love you too. And we'll pass your love on to Allen's family.
Sergeant Brandt had appeared on his way to recovering from multiple gunshot wounds, and his death Friday shocked the city. Recently seated Mayor Jim Matherly recounted how earlier in the week Sergeant Brandt had walked into City Hall and addressed the City Council.
He spoke to us about being united, about what it was like to be a police officer. But this man was so selfless. He actually said, other cops have done more than he has done. He was the one that suffered this horrific event, yet he was thinking of his fellow officers.
Mayor Matherly closed by asking the public to keep Sergeant Brandt's wife and four children in their thoughts and prayers. Sergeant Brandt was shot when he responded to a report of gunfire on a downtown street after midnight on October 16th. The man who shot Brandt, 29-year-old Anthony Jenkins Alexi of Anchorage, is jailed on multiple charges. A confession note says he shot Brandt out of revenge for police killings of relatives and friends. Sergeant Brandt is the second FPD officer to be killed in the line of duty in recent history. Officer Kevin Lamb was shot in 1998. Services for Sergeant Brandt are being planned. In Fairbanks, Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, another round of ACA insurance enrollment starts tomorrow.
We also are encouraging people to reach out to a broker, a navigator, or an assister, depending what is in their area, to help them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Races up and down the ticket have candidates dropping party affiliations. But is this an ideological shift or just a new kind of political calculus? Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes looks at one Anchorage race to find out.
There's a heavily Republican part of Southwest Anchorage, House District 22, that could very feasibly elect an independent representative. Political newcomer Jason Gren.
I literally did not know where the Division of Elections was.
Gren was, up until a few months ago, a lifelong Republican. His wife is still registered with the party. But after feeling like the state GOP has drifted further to the right of his own moderate beliefs and hearing frustrations about the district's incumbent, Gren decided on a last-minute run.
We decided it was okay, and we needed to do this, and the timing in our life was good, and the timing for our state was good.
By good timing, Gren means what is, in his view, the state's biggest single issue, the need to secure a comprehensive budget solution, a topic that he's been loosely involved with even before his candidacy. But there may be another timing advantage. Gren is part of a trend this election cycle of strong independent runs for office. He's one of three new legislative candidates running as an independent in Anchorage. In Southeast, Dan Ortiz is running to keep his spot as an independent in the State House. In the U.S. Senate race, independent Margaret Stock trails well behind incumbent Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski, but Stock has pulled in around $500,000 so far in donations. Gren says that as he's door-knocked in the district, his non-affiliated status has helped him connect with voters on issues rather than getting stonewalled over party membership. It's an optimistic bipartisan vision that Gren's opponent, incumbent Republican Liz Vasquez, doesn't find plausible.
He's really a Trojan horse because he really hasn't exposed what he really thinks and how he thinks.
Vasquez says independents like Gren are, in fact, Democrats going by another name. She points to Gren's prominent liberal donors, including public employees and unions. Gren also got a $5,000 donation from Together for Alaska, a PAC made up of labor interests with massive contributions from attorney Robin Brenna. Vasquez says that after Walker's victory as an independent, his allies are trying to replicate that success by backing other independents they think will help advance a similar agenda.
It did work for the governor. He did run, quote, as an independent, although there's a lot of buyer's remorse on that. People are now seeing for what he really is. And he's not as independent as he claimed.
Vasquez and leaders of the state Republican Party see the independent push as having two components. The first is political opportunism by Democrats to break apart Republican control in the legislature. GOP Chairman Tuckerman Babcock says state Dems are going along with independents by pulling or not running candidates of their own in some races and by putting major money behind their campaigns.
There are some strange bedfellows. The Democrats themselves have not been in the majority for decades, and they very much would like to be in the seats of power to advance Democratic policies.
The second path, as the GOP sees it, is an effort by Walker and political allies outside the party system to address the budget crisis with their fiscal strategy. To Babcock, these independent partisans are loosely united on an economic platform that includes an income tax, cuts to the dividend, increased oil taxes, and minimal cuts to state government. The alliance, he thinks, will be temporary.
In my opinion, it's definitely a flash in the pan, and it's a unique set of circumstances that have come up.
But that doesn't account for why independent candidates are getting traction with voters in districts with Republican incumbents, or why, unlike the third candidate in the District 22 race, independent Dustin Darden, funders have stepped in with a lot of cash for some of them. Taylor Bickford is a Republican political consultant who's not working for a campaign this cycle. He said recently on the Midnight Sun podcast that part of the reason independents like Gren are politically viable right now is dissatisfaction with how Republicans have governed in the legislature.
I think that incumbents are unpopular everywhere. I think Republican incumbents are especially unpopular everywhere in the state. And I think that in some ways it has less to do with him and his campaign as it has to do with just the simple math and structural advantage that you have as an independent running against a Republican without a Democrat on the ballot.
And that dissatisfaction isn't exclusive to the legislature. With low favorability ratings across the country for the two-party candidates running for president, Bickford and others say there could be a down-ballot boost for anyone without a D or an R next to their name. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
On November 8th, Alaskans will vote on Ballot Initiative 1, which would automatically register eligible individuals to vote when they apply for a PFD unless they opt out. Through mid-October, the campaign in favor of the initiative has spent more than $1 million despite the lack of formal opposition. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman learned more about the possible impacts of the change.
In order to vote in Alaska, a person needs to register 30 days before the election. That means going to a place like the DMV or a tribal office to fill out a form, printing the application and mailing it in, or using the new online option. A bipartisan coalition of organizations and state leaders hope to add one more way: automatic voter registration. If Ballot Measure 1 passes, when you apply for your PFD, you'll be automatically registered to vote unless you opt out. Five states have recently enacted similar automatic voter registration laws. Professor Barry Burden with the Elections Research Center at the University of Wisconsin says in most countries, all voters are automatically registered. He says The process was created in the United States about 120 years ago for a reason.
So one of the incentives for voter registration was to prevent fraud and try to provide a secure system for ensuring that each person got to vote once and only once. But it was also an effort to try to keep immigrants from participating or keep undesirable populations, transient groups, sometimes Irish or German populations from participating. And so it had a kind of discriminatory effect.
Burton says automatic voter registration can reduce some of those problems. Oregon is the only state where automatic registration is already happening, and it was just implemented, so it's too soon to see how it impacts voter turnout. But Burton says other data suggest the practice will get more people to the polls.
There are surveys, for example, in previous presidential elections that ask non-voters why they didn't vote. In 2012, something between 5 and 6% of non-voters told us the reason was something related to voter registration. So it's likely to have a modest but positive effect on voter turnout.
The Division of Elections estimates that automatic registration could catch up to 70,000 people who are qualified to vote but not registered. The process, if implemented, would also update registration records. Kim Reitmeier, who's helping run the campaign in favor of the ballot initiative, says if it passes, organizations like Get Out the Native Vote can shift focus from registration to voter education.
We're hoping that, you know, by allowing people to have this automatic process, they then can put their resources and time to learning who they might want to vote for, the ballot initiatives, a little bit more of that education process, too.
But Suzanne Downing, who writes the political blog Must Read Alaska, says the initiative solves a problem that doesn't exist because people can already register in many different ways.
And it is a function of citizenship that you go and you actually fill out one form, very easy to do, and if you can file for your PFD, you could certainly figure out how to register to vote.
She also says it's an expensive proposition. In 2015, the Lieutenant Governor's office estimated that if the ballot initiative passed, it could cost about $930,000 to implement and $300,000 every year after that. Proponents of the cause say those numbers are outdated because they don't reflect Division of Elections computer upgrades that have already happened or how much time and money can be saved by sharing data. The division itself says they just don't know yet. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Open enrollment in the federal health insurance marketplace begins tomorrow. Two-thirds of Alaskans already enrolled will see about a 35% rate increase as they transfer to the lone provider left in Alaska's market. Lori Wing Heyer is the director of the state's Division of Insurance. She says about 14,000 individuals will swap over to Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Their plan will automatically go from Moda to Premera, but if they want to see what else is out there, they're going to have to go into the marketplace and make the decision themselves, because it may not be the plan that they want due to the cost. So we are encouraging them to get out and take a look at what the new plan is and if it's the correct plan for them at the correct premium.
Moda announced their departure from the individual market in Alaska earlier this year, citing financial troubles. Customers already enrolled with Premera will see an average rate increase of 7.3%. Wing Heyer says the state is encouraging Alaskans to start shopping early. About three-quarters of enrolled Alaskans qualify for a substantial subsidy. Wing Heyer says assistance is available for those who are re-enrolling and for Alaskans enrolling for the first time.
We also are encouraging people to reach out to a broker, a navigator, or an assister, depending what is in their area, to help them, to walk them through the marketplace and what their options are.
The enrollment period is open through the end of January, but to have insurance coverage in effect by the first of the year, the enrollment deadline is December 15th. As of September, just over 21,000 Alaskans were enrolled in the individual marketplace. An Anchorage-based fuel service company violated federal clean air standards for more than a decade. The Environmental Protection Agency announced a fine against Shoreside Petroleum Incorporated today. The company operates fuel terminals in Seward and Cordova, where the violations were discovered. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more from Juneau.
For more than a decade, Shoreside Petroleum Incorporated was leaking gasoline vapor into the air around Seward and Cordova. The company operates marine terminals throughout South Central Alaska, where it receives, stores, and then ships fuel to customers. And, according to the Environmental Protection Agency, the company wasn't checking for gasoline vapor leaks, loaded fuel into substandard trucks, and didn't have the necessary equipment in place to control emissions.
If you've ever put gasoline in your car and you smell gasoline fumes, that's the fumes coming from Shoreside's operations.
That's John Pavitt. He's the air quality inspector for the EPA who handled the agency's case against Shoreside. Those fumes don't just smell bad, they can be hazardous. Pavitt says they contain chemicals that are known to cause cancer, respiratory problems, and cardiovascular disease. The EPA announced $89,000 in fines for the company, but that fine could have been much higher. Pavitt says if the EPA had discovered the violations, the result could have been hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines. But Shoreside took advantage of a new self-audit program with the EPA that allows companies to self-report violations, and that lowers the amount of penalties that companies have to pay. In 2014, the company reported violations dating back to 2005. No one from Shoreside Petroleum returned calls seeking comment. After the company reported the violations, it had to buy testing equipment and report the results to the EPA. It also had to pay to install pollution controls and check for leaks. It spent more than $400,000 to bring the two locations up to code. All told, the EPA estimates these new controls reduced the company's pollution emissions by nearly 30 tons a year in Seward and 9 tons a year in Cordova.
According to the information they gave us, they have more than 5 million gallons a year of product. And so if 30 tons is it's a small amount of what they're handling.
According to the terms of the settlement, Shoreside Petroleum doesn't have to admit or deny that it committed the violations. It also must pay the fine within 30 days. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story.
On dinner tables across the country, Americans are eating more fish. The United States is responsible for more fish consumption than all other countries except for China. An annual National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration report shows Americans added almost 1 pound of fish to their diets in 2015. Zoe Sobel of Alaska's Energy Desk has more from the port responsible for the nation's largest seafood haul.
For the 19th consecutive year, the Port of Dutch Harbor is America's largest fishing port, hauling in 787 million pounds of seafood. That's the most seafood ever brought into one port, and over 250 million pounds more than the next port, Kodiak. The $218 million haul is mostly thanks to the large volume of pollock from the Bering Sea, as well as crab and other groundfish. Former fishery analyst for the City of Onalaska, Frank Kelty, says fishing is the community's main economic engine.
We have no other main industry, and everything feeds off how the fishery is doing, and it works its way down through all sectors of the community.
Although it's more money than last year, Dutch Harbor's haul is still behind the nation's most profitable port, New Bedford, Massachusetts. As a state, Alaska led the country in volume and value of fish landings, bringing in 3 times the money and over 5 times the amount of seafood as the next largest. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
Dooley's costume and tuxedo store in Anchorage will close its doors for good tonight after decades of existence in Alaska. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early talked with the owner about the pending closure.
44-year-old Starla Haim is the owner of Dooley's Tuxedos and Costumes in Anchorage. She's been working at the store since she was 18 years old and helped run the business with her mother, Rose, and Doris Dooley, the original owner. But Ms. Dooley passed away in the early 90s, and her mother passed 4 years ago. That took away much of the passion Haim had for the business.
And it's just, it hasn't been the same without my mother. It just hasn't been the same at all. It was, you know, we were a great team. We did a lot of amazing things together with this business, and I've done my best to try to continue that. And, you know, and I've continued as much as I can, but my passion is just gone.
Haim said she'd originally tried to sell the business, but it didn't have any bites.
We had it on the market for quite a while and realized if nobody wants to take it, we're ready to be done, and figured the best way to do it is to go out with a bang on Halloween Day.
While Dooley's had some tuxedos on display, it was obvious the main attraction for the blowout was costumes. The store was covered, wall to wall, with everything from children's Marvel superhero costumes to adult Starflower hippie and sexy pirates. Haim says the store originally opened in Fairbanks in the mid-1940s, but it has been an Anchorage staple for so long, even she doesn't know when the business migrated to South Central.
That's where it's a little fuzzy for me, because I don't have like the documented history. I just know the stories that Doris Dooley would tell me, and there was never like an actual, you know, date. But it was, I want to say, she talked about the great flood in Fairbanks that brought her from Fairbanks. And from what I understand, that was around the mid to late 60s. And so it's been in Anchorage since the mid to late 60s.
Haim says that being a small mom-and-pop store in Alaska created challenges throughout the years. The emergence of online shopping in recent years is a large problem small family-owned Alaska businesses face.
Especially with the new age and the new times and everything on the internet and all the big box stores, it's a battle to be a mom-and-pop store anymore. It's a fight, and it's just not a fight that we want to fight anymore.
The community response to the closing of the store has been positive, Haim says. And she's happy she's ending the business while she still feels attached to the community.
It was this last prom season that I put, you know, was able to help somebody, and they were so extremely happy, and I was so extremely happy, and I loved every minute of it. But I still, when I was done, thought, I don't want to do this anymore. Even though I was still happy, and even though that used to make me think, I love doing this, and this is something I want to always do, that's when I knew I was done. It was when I still loved doing it, but knew I was still done.
To any last-minute Halloween shoppers, you'll have until 8 p.m. tonight to stop by and grab a costume before Dooley's closes for good. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. And you can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Liz Ruskin, Zachariah Hughes, Josh Edge, Ann Hillman, and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Rasha McChesney in Juneau, and Zoe Sobel in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. It's no secret that salmon is important to Alaskans. It brings us together across communities, cultures, and economies. Discover what you can do to ensure healthy runs of salmon for generations to come by visiting salmonproject.org/20ways. This message is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.